Back going here.
20, 21, and 25.
All right, you'll find that list. It's a salmon-colored list. No, it's a blue list. It's a blue list. I've got the special list. All right. That's right. Yeah. All right, the first bill for our consideration is Senate File 16. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 16, introduced by Minerals, Business, and Economic Development. Financial Assurance, Class 1 and 5, UIC Wells, an act relating to environmental quality. Mr. Chairman, this bill was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Clausen, Crank, Ayer, Gray, Greer, Henderson, Lindholm, and Laux. Excused, Representative Byrd. Signed, Representative Greer, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Greer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that with the Committee of the Whole rises report to do so with the recommendation that Senate File 16 do pass. And I was going to have my committee member, the gentleman from House District 41, present the bill. I don't see him, so I'll go ahead and present it. There are no amendments. So, members, I was attending a presentation, joint presentation with the Ag Committee and the Minerals Committee on issues of water quality, and it caught my attention that we did not have, a comment was made that we did not have financial assurances in our rules, regulations, or statutes for Class 1 and Class 5 wells. And I thought that was odd. And then as I asked some questions, we discovered that we have some issues with Class 5 wells being orphaned. And I'll just give you a little history. The Class 1 wells are basically the deep disposal commercial wells that are permitted by the department that oversees environmental quality. Class 5 wells are more shallow, and what they include really was the coal bed methane reinjection. And I don't know if y'all recall, but there was a push a while ago to go back into some of those aquifers and put some microbes in to stimulate the growth that created the methane in those wells. And so there were, I'll just give you some stats right now. So with respect to the Class 1 wells, there's 49 of them, and they're all bonded. They have financial assurances in place. There's no risk to the state. With the Class 5, there are 492 wells. 318 of them were bonded. There's some cross-jurisdiction with oil and gas, or they were bonded, permitted initially by the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. Those all have financial assurances. Of the remaining 174, we got 175 that are still operating right now. And then, unfortunately, we got 69 that are orphaned, which will be cleaned up using the conservation tax fee that is paid by industry. Industry does pay for these types of cleanups. So what this bill does is it puts us in place so that as these permits are issued in the future, that the financial assurances will be in place. That is bonding to make sure that we don't have orphan sites. In addition, I think these are 10-year permits, and so every 10 years they come up for renewal. So meaning those 105 that are still operating will come up for renewal at some point in time, and we'll be able to get some bonding in place. This is just a nice catch to be able to ensure that we're able to continue responsible development in the state and take care of the environment. So just, again, something that just caught our attention. We brought this as an interim topic, and I'll stand for any questions.
Any discussion on the bill? Representative Barlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I have both these types of wells on the property that I live on, I guess my question, there's probably three questions. One question is my understanding that Class 1 wells also have a obligation to that commission that oversees hydrocarbon production in our state, that commission. And so I wonder if this is either, I just want to ensure, this is duplicative of what they're doing, or is it standalone? So that would be my first question. Second question would be, there are other classes of underground injection wells. This refers to 1 and 5, and there are others. And you see some of the stricken language refers to the Code of Federal Regulations that would include those other injection well types. Now, maybe they aren't relevant to the state of Wyoming. I won't speak to that, but I just want to have that clarified. I guess those are the two questions I'd have. One, class wells, is there duplication within that other agency commission that deals with this stuff? And two, about the other classes that seem to be stricken from this if that CFR being stated is inclusive of all different kinds of injection wells. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Greer.
Well, I will try to answer the question, and I can't be certain on the stricken language of the CFR. And so I don't want to, as the testimony was taken, there was no intent to strike or remove anything from the list. And I don't want to tell you that for certain. I want to make sure I know that for a fact. The other types of wells that are there, and I don't have all this memorized. I wish I did. Not really, but I wish I could answer your question better. Are governed either by the oil and or by the Commission that oversees oil and gas production, or by the EPA itself, rather than the state agency. So that's why they're not listed. With the class one, as my understanding is, this is in addition to what that commission does that oversees the oil and gas production. So, again, the targeted area here of most concern were those Class 5 wells. And, again, some of those Class 5 wells, by the commission, were actually bonded with financial assurances, but we ended up with a certain set that were permitted just by this department, and they said they didn't have any authority to require bonding. So we're giving them the authority and actually a statutory statement to do so. With respect to the CFR, I did not look that up. I will do so. I will try to get you a direct answer on that.
Any other discussion? Is there a call for the question? Question being called, all those in favor of Chairman Greer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, and do so with the recommendation that Senate File 16 do pass, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 16 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 18. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 18, introduced by Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, Orphan Site Remediation Funding, an act relating to environmental quality. Mr. Chairman, this bill was referred to your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Clausen, Crank, Ayer, Gray, Greer, Henderson, Lindholm, and Laux. Excused, Representative Byrd. Signed, Representative Greer, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Greer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises report to do so with a recommendation that Senate File 18 do pass, and for an explanation of the bill, I'll turn it over to the good gentleman from House District 6.
Representative Clausen.
Basically what this bill does is it provides for funding for orphan site remediation. It allows the department that takes care of environmental quality to use funds from the corrective action account, pages 3 through 6 are just a schedule of how those funds will be distributed between the solid waste landfill remediation account and the orphan site remediation account. With that, I'll stand for any questions.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Greer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 18 do pass, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 18 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 20. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 20, introduced by Judiciary. Custody in the Best Interest of the Children, an act relating to child custody. Mr. Chairman, this bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Biteman, Jennings, Kirkbride, Olson, Pelkey, Pannell, Salazar, Stith, and Winters. Signed, Representative Kirkbride, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Kirkbride.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee the whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File Number 20 do pass. I was looking for the presenter of the bill, who does not appear to be in the room. Olson? Okay. Mr. Chairman, if we might have a moment.
We'll take a pause. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee of the whole, or has that already been moved? Okay. We're on Senate File 20. This is the custody in the best interest of the children. This is a short bill, and I'm going to point you to the bottom of page 1. All this bill does is say, clear in our statute, that when determining a custody outcome, a court shall not favor or disfavor any form of custody. Now, why do we want to do that? Well, if you look in your inboxes, you'll find a court case placed in your box. And if you just kind of move through that, you'll see a spot where we have some underlined language. This is a very recent court case. Came out in November during the interim, just a couple days before our final committee meeting with the judiciary. Hold on, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to grab a copy real quick. And the way this works, Mr. Chairman, the statute in Wyoming for since it was written has provided for three types of custody. You'll find those on your bill on page 2. Top of page 2, you can have, after a divorce or in a custody proceeding, you can have joint custody, shared custody, or sole custody. The problem that we have in Wyoming is that through time, a presumption was built against shared custody. If you look at page 5 in that packet that I handed out to you with the Supreme Court case, I want you to look there because there is a concurring opinion from the chief of the court that is supreme, and he writes, this presumption, and he's talking about the presumption against shared custody. He says, well, first he says the majority is correct that shared custody in its various forms is not favored in Wyoming law. That's important because until I think in the last year, there's been a conversation in Wyoming that there is no presumption against shared custody, even though we have a Supreme Court case that says that. But here, the reason why I'm pointing that out to you is because I want you to see the court in its own writing making it very clear that there is, in fact, a presumption against shared custody. But the chief further writes, I believe, however, that a presumption against shared custody is no longer appropriate. He goes on to say, the presumption is inconsistent with the statutory directive. What's he talking about? He's talking about the statute that I just read to you. When this legislature enacted the statute, it put all three forms of custody on an equal playing field. And it said, these are the forms of custody that you can have. Now go and prove what's in the best interest of the child. That's the standard, best interest of the child. But the problem is they're not on an equal playing field, which deviated from legislative intent. I think what you see here with this brand new Supreme Court case is a shift in the judiciary's understanding in our present time of shared custody and a willingness to revisit that presumption. So the other reason I point that out to you folks is because I don't want this bill to come off too strong in the sense that the bill is stepping on the toes of our judiciary. That is not the hope or the intent of the bill. But at this point in time, I think we're moving along closer in sync than we were a year ago. And I can't speak for all members of that judiciary and where they may stand on it. But that's neither here nor there because this is the legislative body. This is the people's house. This is the body that sets the law. And what we're asking you to do is put all of those forms of custody on a level playing field. The parties litigate it. They still have to prove best interests. And you got a snapshot into this on introduction on a different bill. But the reality is, all you have to know is that if it's not in the best interest of the child, and an attorney in the party can prove that, then the court's not going to award it. It's going to award one of those other two forms of custody. All we're doing is putting, once again, all forms on an equal playing field. So I'd urge an aye vote, and subject to any questions.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Kirkbride's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 20 do pass, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 20 has passed the Committee of the Whole. We're on Senate File 21. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 21, introduced by Judiciary. Required reports in adoptions. An act relating to adoption. Mr. Chairman, this bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Biteman, Jennings, Kirkbride, Olson, Pelkey, Ponell, Salazar, Stith, and Winters. Signed, Representative Kirkbride, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Kirkbride.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so at the recommendation that Bill Number 21 do pass. And for the explanation, once again, the good representative from District 11.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, this bill, what it deals with is in some respects a cleanup. So in adoption law, there is a special form that we have to complete as attorneys when we represent folks going through an adoption, and we have to provide all this information that you'll see on page 2 of your bill. We have to provide that information to the court that then goes to the Department of Health. And the reason why we do that is to issue a new birth certificate after an adoption. Well, the current law is a little unclear on when you have to provide that form and exactly whose obligation it is. Is it the clerk's obligation or the attorney's obligation? So what we have across Wyoming is we get to the end of an adoption and all of a sudden, some attorneys might submit it and some might not. Well, all this law does is say that at the moment you file your petition for adoption, you must provide this form at the time of filing, and that's for the vital records for the state department that oversees our health, providing the sex, date of birth, place of birth, the birth certificate number, a natural mother's name, natural father's full name, etc. So again, all this bill does is move that up to the front end of the process. It was already required. We're just requiring it at the filing of the petition. And the only other thing I'll add to this is that one county, the county that you're in, was the pilot program for this. So while this bill moved along through the interim, my county experimented with this and required it. And I do adoptions all over the state, and there were other counties where it wasn't required, and I can tell you there were a few moments where I myself realized as I was submitting my decree of adoption that I needed to submit this form as well. And so I found personally in this great county that the requirement up front, it works, because what happens is when you don't have it, the clerk will send your petition right back with you, and then you got to fill that out and send it back in. And subject to your questions, urging an aye vote.
Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And also just to agree with what you just heard, but also give you the perspective of someone who's had the privilege of adopting three children, this particular process, making it smoother, simpler, this is a great amount of work that went into it to make something that quick and simple and easy. And so, again, I also urge your aye vote.
Any other discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Kirkbride's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 21 do pass, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 21 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 25. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 25, introduced by Judiciary. Corrections Exception to Defense of Habitation Law, an act relating to crimes and offenses. Mr. Chairman, this bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Representatives Biteman, Jennings, Kirkbride, Olson, Pelkey, Pawnell, Salazar, Stith, and Winters. Signed, Representative Kirkbride, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Kirkbride.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File Number 25 do pass. For the explanation of the bill, our good colleague from the land of coal and camels.
Representative Pawnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, this bill is pretty short and simple. It amends the law to exempt folks that are in corrections and law enforcement, and basically that work in jails and correctional facilities that through the habitat laws that we have in place, that it kind of protects them. It doesn't give the right of a criminal to use that as a defense, as somebody going into their jail cell, that it has the right to be there. So there's an amendment to this bill, and I would move amendment House or the amendment number 1 to Senate File 25, and we'll explain a little bit about that. And it's on page 2, line 3, and it basically removes some of the wording there, and there's a reason behind that. After officer, you delete the following words up to corrections, and then you put in or, and then it goes to corrections, and you basically eliminate the rest of the sentence. And what this is doing is, in that paragraph, is that DOC does not have any individuals that work at those facilities, and it would not partake in that part of it, so there was no need to put that in there. So back to the main bill, I'm going to ask you all to support it, because, as we all know, if you're in jail, you don't have the same rights as you are in your own home. So I urge you an aye vote on this bill.
We're on the standing committee amendment. Is there any discussion? Question being called on the standing committee amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Standing committee amendment number 1 has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Any further discussion? Representative Lindholm.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do like what the amendment did, that specifically took out, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that takes out the secure facility aspect. And I guess I would question in regards to what we're looking at here is we're essentially saying, mind you, members, this is under use of force and self-defense. So we're essentially saying that anyone that could be in one of these facilities has no right to self-defense, regardless of what is happening to them, because we're not actually putting any provision to state that these individuals have certain aspects of right to self-defense. So, as of right now, I'm a heavy no on this legislation, based on the premise that are we essentially saying that individuals that are incarcerated at that point have less rights? Can you explain that, please? Thank you.
Chairman Greer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I kind of like this bill as amended. And here's the reason why is, you know, folks that are incarcerated have a lot of time on their hands. And we have to provide them copies of the statutes and the federal laws. And we have folks called jailhouse lawyers. And so they spend a lot of time bringing all kinds of motions and lawsuits for their rights, their their so-called liberties being violated, their rights being violated. And all this does is just shut down one of those avenues to make it really clear that you don't have a right to self-defense in a jail cell you're sitting in. That's all. It's just a nice cleanup to prevent one of these frivolous lawsuits from moving forward through the system. So I stand in favor of this bill.
Representative Lindholm.
Yeah, and thank you. I appreciated the use of so-called rights. I think that's an important aspect when you're looking at this legislation, because that's essentially what's happening here, is you suddenly move to this aspect of just having so-called rights. Well, moving on to the rest of the legislation on page 2, you can see on lines 15 through 18, but does not include the inmate housing area of a jail, state penal institution, or other secure facility. So I would question the Judiciary's Committee's wisdom on using the term secure facility, based on the premise that secure facility is not defined in Wyoming statute anywhere. Also, on top of that, the only place it is defined where I believe this would turn to would be under what is currently defined as secure facility under the U.S. or the Department of Health and Human Services. So that's pretty broad. So let's look at secure facility, also called a training school, reformatory, detention center, jail, or secure hospital. So how far will this actually expand to? And then that's really part of the problem.
Chairman Greer.
Yeah, so Mr. Chairman, what I would humbly suggest is you turn over, look on page 3 and read that line, because we talk in terms of other secured facility under contract with the Department of Corrections. So that would maybe solve that last concern. I would hope it would anyway with that. And you know, so we talk in terms of so-called rights. When you are arrested, convicted of a felony, there are a series of rights that you lose. Some of them you lose forever. It's part of being a felon. This body's actually been pretty good about trying to restore some of those rights. But the simple fact is, when you're a convicted felon, you do lose certain rights.
Madam Minority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and against this, I think. This is one of the bills that you need to honestly kind of put it in the context of the statute that it's part of. And so we're in a justification section about when you can use self-defense. And you'll see that you have to refer to Part A in order to understand what Part B is about. And this bill is about Part B. But Part A says that a person is presumed to have held a reasonable fear of imminent peril of death or serious bodily injury, and then it goes on, when the intruder against whom the defensive force was used was in the process of unlawfully and forcefully entering, right? So a prison guard would not be unlawfully or forcefully entering if he or she was doing their job. And so when you understand A, B is actually talking about defensive force against unlawful entry by that correctional officer. So when you read it in context, this doesn't seem to make sense to me.
Representative Stith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and for SF 25, with respect to the right of self-defense, and an inmate, if we adopt this, an inmate will still have his common law right of self-defense. All this bill does is to remove the inmate from the operation of our Castle Doctrine bill. The Castle Doctrine bill creates the presumption that you acted reasonably, a rebuttable presumption that you acted reasonably if someone unlawfully entered your residence. With respect to, so if we have the scenario where one inmate enters another inmate's cell, and that inmate may not be privileged to enter that, so it would be unlawful. Without this bill, then the inmate into whose cell someone has, another inmate has entered, that inmate can then essentially kill that person and say I get the benefit of a rebuttable presumption that I acted reasonably. All this bill does is to say you don't get that rebuttable presumption that you acted reasonably. An inmate, the common law still applies to reasonable self-defense. Thank you.
Mr. Minority Whip Pelkey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did want to just, I love this term, push back gently on the comments of the old country lawyer who decided that it was that this bill essentially covered convicted felons. If you read the bill carefully, it could be anyone from your next door neighbor picked up on a DUI on a Friday night and spending the weekend in jail, presumed innocent, but still not subject to the protections of this law. I think the way the law is written, I'll use another hackneyed cliche here and say that it's not ready for prime time and urge your vote no.
Chairman Greer.
So, Mr. Chairman, as a follow-up on the comments from the minority floor leader, so as I look at this in total, when we're at 602B, and we come into the presumption set forth does not apply to, but we're talking about Romanet 3 on this. And Romanet 3 is, and these are ors, Romanet 1, 2, and then 3 are ors. And Romanet 3 is regarding a peace officer performing their duties, their official duties, which, again, if someone has, and so, again, to just the last comments, a parole officer has certain official duties when dealing with convicted felons out on parole. We've just passed legislation trying to make that more of an alternative than just pure incarceration. But in order to do that, there are certain things that need to be done. These people are tested. There's a whole checklist of items and rules that they have to go through, follow, and we have to have somebody checking up on them. That's the overall welfare of society. So I just want to make sure this is not becoming some overbroad issue here. What we're talking about are peace officers doing their duties, and now we're talking about correctional officers doing their official duties. If that tends to go into a convicted felon's home with respect to the official duties of a parole officer, I think we need to encourage that. We're trying to encourage other alternatives other than incarceration. So again, let's not make too much out of it. Let's just look at what the correction was being done by the Judiciary Committee.
Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to return your attention then to page number 2, let me give you just a little background of my amendment in committee that actually struck a portion of page number 2, but I didn't strike it in every single instance. On page 2, as you look at lines 4 through 6, we did move to strike or employee of any other secure facility under contract to the Department of Corrections to house inmates. That actually was something that we were contemplating in that particular area, a peace officer. But then as you move down to little D, Romanet's I and 2I, you look at that, the reason why we didn't strike it there are facilities in the state of Wyoming that are utilized sometimes for Title 25 instances and those sorts of things. And there are opportunities occasionally where people might have a home checkup. And so we were, again, like the previous speaker said, we're not trying to make this overly broad. We were trying to limit it, trying to find that sweet spot to where this would do what it's designed to do. But by continuing to strike throughout the remainder of the bill, you actually, I think, could damage the bill. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll also pitch into the conversation.
Any other discussion on the bill? Representative Walters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In reading 6-2-602, Romanet A person is presumed to have held a reasonable fear of imminent peril of death or serious bodily injury to himself or another when using defensive force that is intended or likely to cause death or serious bodily injury to another if, Romanet I, the intruder against whom the defensive force was used, was in the process of unlawfully and forcefully entering or had unlawfully and forcibly entered another's home or habitation, or if that intruder had removed or was attempting to remove another against his will from his home or habitation. And Romanet 2, the person who uses defensive force knew or had reason to believe that it was that an unlawful and forcible entry or unlawful and forcible act was occurring. Subsection B. The presumption set forth in this subsection A of this section does not apply if Romanet I, the person against whom the defensive force is used, has the right to be in or is a lawful resident of the home or habitation, such as an owner, lessee, title holder, and there is not an injunction and protection from domestic violence or written pretrial supervision order of no contact against that person. Romanet 2. The person sought to be removed is a child or grandchild or is otherwise in the lawful custody or under the lawful guardianship of the person against whom the defensive force is used. Or Romanet 3. The person against whom defensive force is used is a peace officer who enters or attempts to enter another's home or habitation in the performance of his official duties. A person who unlawfully and by force enters or attempts to enter another's home or habitation is presumed to be doing so with the intent to commit an unlawful act involving force or violence. As used in this section, habitation means any structure which is designed or adapted for overnight accommodations, including but not limited to buildings, modular units, trailers, campers, and tents. A home means any occupied residence or dwelling. And I would also note that habitation does not necessarily include your vehicle if you just choose to sleep in it overnight. So I'm not certain that we really need this bill. I think that it's already laid out very clear, and thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Pennell.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. All we're trying to include is correction officers. Peace officers are already in there, and I might have misspoke, not explained myself quite well, but we're including correction officers, folks that work and work for the Department of Corrections. That's what we're trying to get in here, because currently under the law, they're not covered. So that's all we're asking.
Chairman Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I was going to bring up the statutes and read a little bit more statute to everybody, but I can't read quite as fast. But, I'm on in favor of this bill, but my problem is, what happens if you've got someone who is on home arrest or has an ankle bracelet and he's protecting his home under the Castle Doctrine? So I've just asked the good bringer of the bill to address that issue and how we deal with it, because once you create a list, then anyone that's outside the list is not covered by the law. So I think we might have a gap here that we might have an amendment to address.
Representative Pennell.
Mr. Chairman, it would also, any agency contracted with the Department of Corrections, which would include parole officers that go to these homes. So it would include those folks under contract that actually work with the Department of Corrections. If I hope that answers the question.
Representative Lindholm.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess I'll try to be quiet after this. I don't know if I will be able to. But specifically, I would like to ask the bringer of this legislation, when and where has this ever happened in the state of Wyoming where an inmate has used this habitation aspect, essentially the Castle Doctrine, for the use of self-defense against a peace officer? Has that happened in the state of Wyoming? Thank you.
Representative Hallinan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question to ask of the bringer of this amendment or this bill. What about those cases where, say, the police go to somebody's house by mistake and actually go in and shoot the person in that house? Does he have a right to self-defense? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This kind of occasion has happened, not in the state of Wyoming, but we don't wait to make good law in Wyoming after someone's dead. We don't wait for that. And so this is a good law now, and it has happened elsewhere. We are trying to make sure that those that serve the public are protected while doing so. And that's the reason why this bill has been brought forth.
Mr. Minority Whip.
Thank you. I just want to make a small correction on what I think I just heard. I think my good fellow committee member is referring to a lawsuit that was filed in a state to the south of us. But that Castle Doctrine in that case was applied as a defense in the death of another inmate, that another inmate walked into that cell and the person effectively used the Castle Doctrine to defend himself, saying that he was, in fact, under imminent threat, and that occurred. So I just wanted some clarification that we're not looking at a parade of examples of peace officers being attacked in their in the act of their rifle duty.
Representative Lindholm.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So effectively, ladies and gentlemen of the 64th, this has never happened in the state of Wyoming. The only time that it has happened has been inmate to inmate. And then on top of that, we're inserting this language of use of force and self-defense. This isn't specific language to only peace officers or to only individuals. This is a big thing. And then open it up to habitation. This applies much more based on the premise of the definition of secure facility, which I explained before. Under secure facility, the only definition that does apply at this time, because we have no definition of secure facility, is on the premise of what is in existing federal law, which is training school, reformatory, detention center, jail, or secure hospital. So I really think that if this does pass through, it needs to be heavily amended, but I am a no vote. Please vote no.
Chairman Greer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, I will point out that it says secured facilities under contract with the Department of Corrections. Okay. The other thing, I think, and then I'll be quiet as well. You know, in this body in particular has been good about this. We've been trying to find ways to find alternatives to incarceration. We've brought a lot of legislation dealing with expungement, restoration of rights, trying to bring some reasonableness into some penalties, all of that of allowing people to move forward with their lives once they've so-called paid their price back to society. One of those tools in the toolbox is definitely to have people on parole, to use halfway houses. If we're going to do that, we also need the oversight and the good work from our people that run the parole offices. And all this is doing is giving that comfort level to them in their official duties, just like what we do with the current exception in there regarding peace officers in their official duties. So there's a little higher policy argument here that is consistent with what I have felt has been the trend with this particular body. I'd encourage an aye vote.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to try to rein us back in a little here. I think this is actually a pretty simple bill and a simple issue. It's a policy question. A policy question of whether this body decides that we ought to stand with those men and women who serve so diligently in our facilities, keeping inmates safe, but also keeping the public safe, and whether we ought to afford them the protections that they deserve when they step in harm's ways. That's an easy policy question. That's a really easy one, I think. Vote aye.
Any other discussion? Representative Walters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 2, when we're discussing this habitation issue, you know, we have buildings in modular units, and then it says not including inmate housing. But what happens if that inmate housing is a modular unit or a trailer or a camper or a tent if we were in certain states? You know, we could bring that same concept back to Wyoming. And so I just don't know that this piece of legislation is quite ready for the bright lights of the House of Representatives. And so I just ask for you to vote no.
Any other discussion? Representative Pinnell.
Well, I just hopefully have the last word on it. I want you to vote in favor of this bill. Remember, it's for the correction officers. Let's keep them in mind when we're making this vote. Thank you.
Question being called. Time to see the bright lights of the day here. All right. All those in favor of Chairman Kirkbride's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, we do so with a recommendation that Senate File 25 do pass. Please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Having failed a standing division vote is required. All those in favor of the bill, please stand. All those opposed, please stand. The bill passes 29-25. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 26. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 26, introduced by Revenue, Nationwide Multi-State Licensing System Collection Agencies, an act relating to collection agencies. Mr. Chairman, this bill was referred to Committee Number 3, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Connolly, Dayton, Furphy, Kenner, Larson, Madden, Obermuller, and Paxton. No, Representative Hallinan. Signed, Representative Madden, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, to do so with the recommendation that Senate File Number 26 do pass. And I will quickly explain. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a result of an interim topic that we had, and the topic was a fee analysis, or I guess a fee assessment, to see if the fees that are associated with certain licenses, among other things, were paying their way, and that we weren't losing money on our activity in the process of licensing. And as it turned out, you know, this was a problem that was discovered before we put it on the agenda, and it was a bill that started in the other end of the building last year, and it passed and unanimously over there, and came over here, and it got we didn't have enough time to get it finished. So anyway, what this involves, folks, is the licensing of collection agencies. And they have pretty complete background checks that are required concerning fraud and concerning just a lot of things that you would probably not want collection agents to have in their record. And what they had been doing with these 500 licenses, these risks, new ones and renewals, annual renewals too, is just going through the hand by, I should research by hand to see how, if anything was negative and whether they should be granted a license. Well, in the meantime, there's this multi-state licensing system, multi-state licensing system that records data on for a lot of different types of licensing, and we use it in the department that manages this for all of their licenses. They have about 4,500 different licenses they grant a year. Of that 4,500, 500 are the collection agencies. Now, the collection agency or the decision on the collection agency whether to grant a license or not rests with a kind of a quasi volunteer board, I think, of three people, and it's called the collection agency board. They have no staff, and the staff that, or I should say the staff that does the work for them is out of the Department of Audit. And they provide the administrative support and also the background support to determine whether a license is should be granted for each of these people. Well, the hours it was taking, because we're using a by-hand approach, if you will, far exceeded the cost, or the $36, I think it is, for a license renewal. And the wish is for on the department that had to do all this work was that they would put the collection agencies under the multi-state licensing system also, just like they're doing for the other 4,000. I don't know what, I suppose, are real estate licenses or and maybe securities licenses and all this kind of stuff that was already covered there. But this is the only one that was left. And that's all this bill really does. It says we're going to put the background work that's done by the agency is going to be done with the assistance of this multi-state licensing system, and they won't have to hire any more people to handle this. I don't know if there's any more questions on it. I can go through it, paragraph by paragraph if you want, but it's not really in the interest of time. I don't think I'll do it unless there's a big interest in pursuing it further. So if there's no questions, and I see no one at the mic, I would move the question, I guess.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Madden's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 26 do pass, please signify by saying aye. Those opposed, no. Senate File 26 is passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 27. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 27, introduced by Revenue. Excise tax audits, an act relating to excise taxes. Mr. Chairman, this bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Connolly, Dayton, Furphy, Hallinan, Kinner, Larson, Madden, Obermuller, and Paxton. Signed, Representative Madden, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure? Chairman Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move it when the Committee of the Whole rises to report. I do so with the recommendation that Senate File Number 27 do pass. And I will have my Vice Chairman from District 29 explain the bill to you.
Vice Chairman Kinner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, before I get into excise tax audits, Senate File 27, I'm going to give you a little history as to why we took a look at this during our interim. And basically, we had an individual in the center of the state come to our good chairman and inquire about the procedures regarding an audit. And when our good chairman began to look into the green books, it became apparent that we could certainly improve upon the situation that he found in the green books. And so as a result, we did look at this as an interim topic, and we worked with the good folks that deal with audits. And we borrowed some procedures that are actually in place over in the minerals section regarding audits. And so what we did on this particular case under excise tax audits, we took a look at this, and we wanted to really memorialize procedures that are actually in place right now and give our actual individuals and businesses some certainty as to how those procedures would take place. And so what we did, we went into Section 3915108, which is sales, and we also went into 3916108, which would be use, under the enforcement section under audits. And here's what we came up with, which I think is really good to state to our citizens and to our businesses what the procedures would actually be. And so under that audit section, what we did was to basically state when the clock would start, and that the clock would start when the prospective person or business received written notice that an audit would be commencing, and that we actually are putting in place a one-year time frame from that initial notice to when the final outcome of the audit would actually be presented. So we put that 1 year in place unless it's extended only upon mutual agreement between the taxpayer and the department itself. And so then what we did was, with that, we wanted to also talk about asking certainly the taxpayer vendor to preserve all records necessary for that audit, to make that pretty clear. And then also we wanted to talk about the time frame with which the audit, could it be 20 years or 5 years? So actually now we have in place the time period that could be looked back would be 3 years preceding the reporting period that the audit was engaged for. So we're talking about a three-year time period now, unless a couple of things happen, unless there's evidence of fraud or actual evidence of gross negligence. Those would open up a little longer period of look back, certainly. And then we also have a provision now, if the taxpayer is not willing or able to produce adequate records. So now we have a provision to deal with that. So again, this is a mirror thing, both in the sales section and in the use section, and really designed to give our taxpayers really adequate notice of what would take place, and then the limits thereon. And really, it's to memorialize again how audits have actually been done, and to provide some certainty. And happy to try to address any questions.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a question, as I see the, I really appreciate having the time frame in business. It just is, as you store all of that information, you're just wondering how long do I need to keep those boxes down there in storage. But when you address that if there's evidence of something amiss, do you address what the maximum time back is? Because still we're not addressing how long we need to keep records, or is that someplace else in the statutes? I'm just wondering, what's the maximum amount of time? Is it still 7 years, or what is it that you're looking, or did you address that?
We did. Representative Kinner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We did not. That's a great question. We did not address that in this particular bill.
Any further discussion?
I'd recommend an aye vote.
Is there a call for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Madden's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 27 do pass, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 27 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 50. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 50, introduced by Revenue, Collection of State Financial Obligations, an act relating to financial obligations owed to the state. Mr. Chairman, this bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Representatives Connolly, Dayton, Furphy, Hallinan, Kenner, Larson, Madden, Obermueller, and Paxton. Signed, Representative Madden, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. There is a standing committee amendment. What is your pleasure, Chairman Madden?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, to do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 50 do pass, or House Senate File History Bill, Senate File 50 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the standing committee amendment. Okay? And what this deals with, folks, is collection fees that are involved with debts that are owed to through the Department of Revenue. So it can be all kinds of different taxes and fees that we assess as a matter of course of business. Now, to take care of the standing committee amendment, basically all this one does is put into the use tax article, which is Article 16, the same language as what we have in actual sales tax or excise tax. And the reason we did that was a committee decision. We did that because use tax is getting to be a bigger and bigger deal. It's we're buying more stuff out of state and actually remotely. So in view of the future, we want this to cover both. And all it does, let me explain how we did it in the past, all right? If we had a bill that was owed to the state, an outstanding obligation owed to the state, we have a pretty aggressive process that we use within the department to secure payment of that. Now, sometimes their methods work, and most of the time, I should say, they work, but once in a while, they don't work, and they get to a point where they turn over the obligation that's owed to us over to a collection agent. What had been happening in the past is if they owed us, let's say, $1,000, the collection agent would go seek that $1,000 or $10,000, whatever it is, and then off of that $10,000, we would have to pay the collection fees, all right? Well, we learned during testimony in May, that every other similar agency in other states, they have a collection fee that can be added on at a certain point. When you get to the point where the department can't is given up on them, they've sent out notices and called them, whatever they do, they get to a point where say this isn't going to be collected in the normal way, and they turn it over, but the letter that they send them saying if you don't pay by X and such and such a time, we're going to turn it to a collection agency with the addition of a collection fee of 20%, okay? And that is what this does. The way we've been doing it now, we can never gain on that, and there was always this back kind of an implicit reluctance to turn it over to a collection agency. But now we will be paid in full, okay? And that's all it does. And I've probably talked too long on it already, but if there's no questions, I call the question.
Question being called on. All right, we're on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, Representative Gray. All right, question being called on the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. All those in favor, say aye. Those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Representative Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I got a quick question. It is on the bill, but when there's collection of bad debt or collection of these debts, does it ever change the flow at any point, what account the revenue flows into?
Chairman Madden.
It does not. It does not change it. And moreover, if the fee is, the 20% is not needed, it's just not charged. But no, it goes into this account, it goes into the general fund, and actually 30% of it goes into local government. So that's how that goes. And one thing I forgot to say about this is just the fact that you have this tool of saying you can send a letter out and add on a collection fee or a service charge will have predicted consequences because people see that letter and they say, well, golly, I better pay it now because they're going to add 20% on, and that really helps. Thank you.
Chairman Barlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So my question is now on the amended bill, with the addition of the new language, which I see as a duplication of what's in the existing bill or existing statute now taken into the use component, is there's a date, initiation date, and that's January of 1989. And so I guess my interest in that is based that this was not in the under use tax currently, and now we're going to put that in. Is there going to be, what level of, how far back are we actually going to go for these uncollected taxes? I just throw that out there because that is exactly what this would allow them to do, is go back to 1989 under this Standing Committee Amendment. And I should have asked it during the Standing Committee Amendment, but it's now part of the bill. So I just ask that from a practical perspective. Are we really talking about going back that far, or are we really talking about going from here forward? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's clearly from this day forward, you know, after it becomes law.
Any further discussion on the bill? Is there a call for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Madden's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that Senate File 50 do pass, please signify by saying aye. Those opposed, no. Senate File 50 has passed the Committee of the Whole. We're now on Senate File 31. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 31, introduced by Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs. Veterans Skilled Nursing Center, an act relating to veterans. Mr. Chairman, this bill was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass, amended. Ayes, Representatives Burkhart, Larson, Nicholas, Summers, Walters, and Wilson. No, Representative Schwartz. Signed, Representative Nicholas, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. There is an amendment. What's your pleasure? Chairman Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee whole rise and report, it does so with a recommendation that Senate File 31 do pass with as amended, and I will turn the initial explanation over to the good chairman of Judiciary. Transportation, sir.
Chairman Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this bill was a committee bill by Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, and it got over to this body and was sent to Appropriations, and it kind of took on a whole new life, and I guess I'd like to start by emphasizing life. It's still alive and well. It's changed a little bit. A new set of eyes looked at it, and I guess I want to explain the journey of where we've been with skilled nursing care for our veterans. It's been going, we've discussed it for 17 years, and we're probably the only state in the country that doesn't, I believe we are the only state in the country that doesn't have one. And we went to management council and requested that we do this. We went to them and promised that it would come at little, if any, cost to the state of Wyoming. So we worked this bill. The way it works is the federal government gives a 65% grant for the building of these facilities, and the state has to provide the rest of the money. So what we were going to do was borrow the money. The Veterans Administration would borrow the 35%, and it would eventually it would be no cost to the state of Wyoming. The stipend that we would receive from the federal government to take care of the veterans was going to pay for the loan. Anyway, so we came with the bill. It looked like a pretty good one. The appropriations looked at it, and they added an amendment to it. And I'm going to have them explain that. What I want you to understand is that the bill is still alive. It will come at little, if any, cost. The timeline for doing this remains the same, possibly might be accelerated. The improvement with the amendment amounts to a more involved study than what the Transportation Committee had originally wanted. We were going to have past studies and use those. The studies would determine the number of beds and the location, both of which we still don't know. The new study will be a more involved study that'll make sure that we're correct on that so that this thing will pay for itself. And I would encourage an aye vote on it, and I would turn over the explanation of the amendment to my friend and colleague across the corner there.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move third reading amendment number one to Senate file 31 and ask for your permission to explain what we're doing.
Representative, you mean standing committee amendment number one?
Yes, standing committee amendment. Thank you. Standing committee amendment number one. So, folks, when we got reviewing this bill as it was referred to the Appropriations Committee, we were actually the benefactors of having a little more time than what the Transportation Committee had moving forward to kind of better understand a little more that has come into play in recent reviews. You will recall, those of you that have been around here, this is an old friend. There's been there was a governor's task force to look at putting a skilled nursing facility at the veterans' home up in the land where the bison are at. Come back the next year and address that in 15, and then there was another alternate attempt to relocate it at another facility because there was some land that was being donated and some private entities were interested in running that facility. And that discussion has gone back and forth up to this date. This bill, as it came to us, really said that it accelerated a level one, level two study and permitted a level three study and give approval for construction of this, what would become a new state facility. But not knowing where, we'd be voting on not knowing where, nor would we know what the costs were. There were some estimates out there, but none of them were in the bill. And so we just thought that we understood the attempt of what they're trying to do to ensure that we qualified for those federal funds. But we also took a look and had the opportunity to look at a study that department who oversees health in the state completed in September at the request of this committee. And the question really became, where should this thing be built? And that answer really is unknown, and actually is even more unknown today with, as we've talked about, the retirement center in Basin and maybe how to move forward with that. But the department that oversees health says if you were going to look solely at the population of where the most veterans are at, you would build it in this community. If it wasn't here, the second next place would be in that county that's east to the county that's right in the center of the state. And if not there, then perhaps in the land of Bison or in the land, the county just north of it. So we're just wondering, we thought that perhaps we just were maybe getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. We think that the idea has merit to look at. And so really what the amendment does is backs off from giving the authority to move forward and actually constructing the facility, but follows the procedures identified in our statute to do a level one and a level two study, and then come back, evaluate that, and do a level three study. And each one of those processes is important because as in each step, it involves us, the legislature, to kind of help determine if there's legislative needs or if we're going to appropriate funds. We really could not appropriate, if we appropriated the funds today, we just really didn't know what that was based on because we didn't know where it was going to be built. We didn't know the design. So what this amendment does is it goes back through your bill, and I'll try and explain this. It changes things up a little bit. If you look at your amendment on line one, after veterans, we delete the balance of the line. On page one, lines two through nine are deleted.
Page 1, line 10, we delete amendments and insert authorizing and planning. Page 1, lines 15 and 16, we delete. Then pages 2 through 12 are deleted entirely. Page 13, lines 1 through 16 are deleted. And then we come in with a section 1 and we give them the authority. We give the Veterans Commission, the Department of Health, and the State Construction Department is authorized to conduct a Level 1, Level 2 plan and design study pursuant to 95108 for that Veterans Fields facility. And then we appropriate $300,000. That was an estimate from the Department of Construction on what it would take to do that. We said up to that. And then when you go to page 13, line 9, we kind of get the reporting back around as these studies come forward. They'll come back and report to the Building Commission and the Standing Committee of Transportation and JAC. We delete on page 13 the language that say that it will be ultimately constructed because we don't know what the recommendations from the Level 1 and Level 2 study will be. We can address that later. If this body likes that, then we'll move to that point. We put back in there the language that those studies have to be in accordance with statutes. They can't be accelerated. They have to go out for an RFP and use the resources there. We do some technical adjustments on page 16, line 17, and then we change the date to October 15th of 2018 to finish this, and then that will give us time in our next legislative session to review what these two studies do, and then we can make any legislative corrections that we need to and move to a Level 3 design and construction if that's the desire of this body. So, Mr. Chairman, in essence, or in totality, that is what this amendment does, and I would be happy to take any questions.
Chairman Madden.
Yes, one question I have is whether or not this study will take into consideration the amount of skilled care, the capacity we have for skilled care facilities here in the state relative to their actual occupancy to kind of come up with some validation of need. And that's a big concern. Maybe this type of facility you don't have to worry about need. I don't know. And the other thing I would wonder about is, you know, over time, you know, old people, I guess elderly people, when they get to needing this kind of care, they have a desire to be have this care administered to them in their hometown or near their hometown. And you know, I want to make sure before we do something like this that we don't end up with a couple of facilities like we have been dealing with in a certain basin that. You know, where it evolves into just another competing facility, and it's local people is dominating the occupancy, and that kind of concerns me. So, if you could just address some of that, I'd be appreciative.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the good chairman of revenue really brings up some important points, and they're points that we discussed in the committee meeting. The capacity really right now statewide is around 83% and that's up in that part of the world where you're from, that's consistent. And what we heard not only from the Department of Health, but that association that represents those people that in the private sector provide long-term care, they're saying that's an accurate number as well. But they also point out that the challenge is also nurses, CNAs and RNs and that sort of thing. And the good chairman is also right, as was confirmed to us by testimony, that people generally they won't go a distance to be in one of these facilities. They like to have it in the proximity of their residency.
And so as we consider various places, and we certainly need to take that into consideration, it needs to probably, well, I'm not going to voice that opinion. It's just what it needs to be. The other interesting thing that come up is that is a decreasing population to a point, which goes again to your point about not overbuilding. And there again, that's why we felt it was important to step back and make sure that we had those studies to identify the populations, what the conditions of the population being served, which would then dictate the type of buildings to be constructed.
Representative Sweeney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the amendment, just a question. Will the studies, phase one, phase two, take into consideration any possible state-owned facilities that are underutilized or not utilized to repurpose?
Representative Larson.
And the good representative from the county east of the county, which is in the center of the state, yes. And there's actually two skilled nursing, there's two areas. One is actually the facility up in the land of Bison that is dedicated for this population but does not have a skilled nursing facility. Another might be that one in that has to do with the retirement of individuals in the state, and that certainly has to be part of the study.
Representative Henderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a combat veteran and from Wyoming, I'm very much in support of the amendment. I like the idea of arranging a better plan to take a closer look. And as far as the question about the closest of relatives and occupants, I think in the future my vision is that we'll get there with some additional sites, and I think it's important to do the study initially so that we have everything ready to go for the application in time.
Chairman Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The number of residents that would be put in one of these should come out of the study. That'll be part of the deal. A state south to the south and west of us has already done this, and they've put in three different ones. And what you do is you apply, and the state kicks it in its money, and it worked well down there, and so they applied a second time and put in a second one, then they put in a third one in various parts of the state. Still with this, the costs are less because the veterans that end up in skilled nursing in Wyoming now land in a hospital, and the costs are much higher there than in a skilled nursing center. So it'll save on our Medicaid bill as part of the deal. And the stipend that comes from the federal government pays for the facility. And if we manage this thing right, it should pay for the maintenance of it. I know people are a little baffled as to how you do it without knowing where. Well, this study should help us out with that. And it could be in multiple locations eventually, but we have to start with one somewhere. And keep in mind that the offer by the federal government, and we're a fortunate state that has savings that can kick into this to loan, it would work out quite well. I have confidence that we can come up with a study that comes up with the accurate and reliable numbers we need to have before we go forward.
Representative Hallinan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Reference the statement of the representative from the county where the buffalo roam regarding the number of people that are available to service these folks and the need for them. Isn't it appropriate that this report should go to the Health and Labor and Social Services Interim Committee to give some opinions on that and to work on this issue appropriately when the time comes? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and for the amendment, I like the idea that I'm seeing here of bumping the study, moving it from August to October. I think giving us more information will make for a better application of what we learn. And so moving that timeline out just a little bit, I like what the amendment does to the bill, and I like the bill overall. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to answer a couple of questions, first to the good doctor, I thought we had that in there, but I absolutely, that committee would be involved, and it has been on all of the other state facilities, and would expect that that would need to likewise be, and, you know, maybe a good amendment. And then I would just help the body to understand, as the chairman of transportation points out, one of the things that makes these attractive is that those individuals that come into there, the majority of them will qualify for Medicaid reimbursement, which is what most of the others do. But then the VA kicks in, and I want to say, I was looking for, I want to say 106 extra dollars a day, which makes those pretty self-sustaining. In fact, actually puts a little black behind them.
Any further discussion on the amendment? Your question for the amendment. We're voting on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. All those in favor say aye. All those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Representative Schwartz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A number of people noted I did not vote for this in committee, and I thought I should offer an explanation of that vote. There were a number of factors. Do you want to fix this before?
That's up to you, Lloyd.
The primary consideration was we've been having a discussion about eliminating two state institutions in committee number 2 for quite some time, and now on the floor of this body. And there's been this discussion of what it is that makes an institution critical for the state to provide. What services should the state be providing? And I'm not sure that this falls into that category necessarily. So that was my first concern. Following up with that, and it came up in the discussion of the amendment, currently there's close to 3,000 skilled nursing facility beds in this state. At 80% capacity, that means there's close to 500 of them empty. So once again, it raises the question, how is this facility providing for a critical need in the state? The third problem I have is there's a lot of assumptions on how this will work as a at least break-even, if not profitable, operation. And if all of the assumptions are correct, we'll be fine. But if all of these assumptions are not correct, the number of veterans that inhabit the bed, because I believe it only has to be 75%, the degree of their disabilities, which determines the amount of the stipend they get, we might have a problem even breaking even. And then on top of that, there's always major maintenance. So I had enough doubts that I was concerned when you start a project like this, I'm sure it's never happened in the state of Wyoming before, but that you start doing studies and there becomes a certain inevitability to the outcome. And so as a consequence, I was a no vote in the committee.
Representative Larson.
Point well taken, members of the House. But as you look at level one studies, the second thing in the level one study is to identify the need of the project. And unless we do that, we will always be questioning. We should have done that or we shouldn't have done that. I don't argue the fact that there will be funds expended, but I think that we need to at some point answer the question. And I think that's why we step back and says you have to comply with the requirements of level one, level two studies found in 95108, because those address some of those exact issues.
Chairman Eklund.
Yes, sir. I guess to address some of the concerns and whether the state should get involved, these are members of our community that have given us a huge service. And the federal government believes that we should be providing this kind of care to those members who need it, not necessarily elderly. They could be members of the armed forces that are injured and unable to function very well without the skilled nursing care. So they've offered this 65% grant, and the stipend that we would get from caring for these citizens will be greater than the loan payment, and should easily pay for maintenance of the same project if we structure the fund that takes care of these facilities properly. Why the state of Wyoming should be involved in it is they live here and they're part of our community, and they are it's something that we owe them. Frankly, we owe them. They should be well cared for. We do not have those facilities for them now. And the other nursing care facilities, I don't believe, received the stipend from the federal government for this. This will actually bring money into the state. We're not meant to make money. But this one is not hard to figure out. I think it's a $400 stipend. And it's a huge benefit for the veterans, and I guess I'd push back on any argument as to whether we should have it here in Wyoming or not.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I guess one of the concerns that I heard was whether or not we should be looking at this because we're just not sure that there's a need for it, and we're talking about the discussion of getting rid of two other state-owned facilities. And my argument back to that particular situation is there is not a private entity that can perform these duties for these veterans the way that the state can and can get this type of reimbursement back from the federal government. So I would counter that argument that we may not have the opportunity to have a private facility for the skilled nursing home for these particular individuals. But in the other two locations, we do have that opportunity, and that's why we're exploring those opportunities. I also think you're talking apples and oranges here, so I want to be careful that we're not splitting the hairs here. This is a critical need for these veterans. We have an aging veteran population. We have a very large population growing into this state. And one of the things that I want to make sure that we do is we watch out for those people that fought for our country and now need this skilled nursing. So I know there's a little bit of hesitation, but this level one and level two study is all this is calling for. This is a very light, light version of the original bill that we sent forward from our committee. So I would encourage an aye vote on this. Let's see what they say in level one and level two before we vote this down.
Chairman Barlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about doing a study, and I'm completely in support of the bill as amended and it's going forth with the study, as was just pointed out. But I would also suggest that there are other further future policy discussions that are going to have to be had. And I'm just going to bring your attention to one. This is in Title 35, and it has to do with something, a concept called a certificate of need. Meaning you can't build more, have more beds if there isn't a certain occupancy level within the current facilities. And currently that's set at 85%. So currently in the state of Wyoming, we can't add any new beds. A private facility could not add any new beds because we're not adding that occupancy level. Caveat that with that anything operated by the federal government or state is not part of that. So this will be a policy discussion for the next time this comes before us. Is this type of facility, should it be subject to this? Should the state be subject to the same thing that we're putting our private entities in? And that's a discussion that, like I said, I'm not debating it here today. I'm saying when those of you who are in this body now come back and there's that level two and you're deciding on level three in construction, they'd be exempt from it currently. But I would urge you that are still here to examine this statute and say, is that the right combination? Are we getting the right mix? I especially encourage it if you're talking about putting it in one of those smaller communities that are already potentially struggling to maintain their own base, their own facility within their own community. So on and for the bill as amended, but I think about there's future policy discussions to be had. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion? Representative, question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Nicholas's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report to do so with the recommendation that Senate File 31 do pass, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Senate File 31 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next file for our consideration is Senate File 32. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 32, introduced by Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs. Criminal Record Dissemination, Military Department, an act relating to criminal procedure. Mr. Chairman, this bill was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Blackburn, Blake, Brown, Court, Crank, Edwards, Eklund, Laux, and Pivarinen. Signed, Representative Eklund, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Eklund.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File Number 32 do pass. And I further turn the explanation of the bill over to my good vice chair from the center of the state.
Vice Chairman Laux.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I'm going to change the pace a little bit up here. This will be a real quick one for you. Senate File 32 is really simple in the fact that right now the military department cannot get information from the state on criminal backgrounds of their military employees, people, whatever. And so all this does is change that. It's authorized the law enforcement entities in the state to release criminal investigation information concerning military members to the Wyoming National Guard. Wyoming National Guard has a need to know about such investigative matters since it impacts a member's deployability, security clearance, ability to be promoted or reassigned, and whether they are allowed to leave the state for formal training. Without this bill, they're not allowed to release the information. So, as you know, this is really important in what's going on these days of getting the right information about people's background. You have guys in the military that might be deploying, and if the military does not... there's ongoing criminal investigation. When they deploy them overseas, it creates another type of problem. So what it does, it goes into two areas, 719-106 and 719-201, and basically changing language so they can, so the state can release the information. It's not like they don't want to. We did study this in intern committee, and it went over really well. It was voted on 9-0 out of committee. There was one change. You have an engrossed copy before you from the Senate. The one change they made was on page 2, lines 6 and 7, where they added the language that said, including any completed investigations, and that was a good catch on their part, so we sure didn't mind that change in there. The second section of the bill, 719, basically has to do with fingerprinting of military personnel. Puts the same language in there, so that information that they get out of the background checks nationally and statewide can be passed on to the military. I ask for your favorable vote on this, and I'll stand for any questions. Thank you very much.
Any further discussion? Do we hear a call for Chairman Greer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just maybe a little more on this. We're, it seems like we're in committee of the whole, but you know, there's a huge difference between a conviction and an investigation. And a completed investigation may contain a whole wealth of information that is discovered. Might even be discovered that the person that's being investigated doesn't even realize was there or put into that. There just aren't too many safeguards on that. I'm just curious what safeguards are there. I sure hate to see somebody's career be jeopardized because of something in an investigation that's really not relevant, put somebody in a bad light. So I'm just curious what you talked about in terms of safeguards.
Vice Chairman Laux.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, and to my good chairman across the room there. You know, I'm sure the legal aspects of it is that's your bailiwick. All I know is, you know, when you sign up for the military, you're under a different set of rules and regs there, too, and there's things that they have to agree to and sign, including the background checks and stuff. And so I just leave it up to the military. They need this so they can, you know, safeguard everybody if there's something going on with one of their members and they're not aware of it. Thank you.
Representative Crank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think what they brought up in committee is sometimes they have deployment things that are going to go out, and they kind of need this to know so they don't deploy somebody out of the country in the middle if there's some kind of investigation going on. So that's why they would like that information.
Any further discussion? Representative Lindholm.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just wanted to see if you could speak a little bit, and I'm sorry if I missed that, in regards to non-judicial punishment, which is essentially what this is. It's non-judicial punishment is what we're allowing to be disseminated at this point. And non-judicial punishment, having been a participant while I was in the military, does not involve a jury or anything like that, whereas our judicial punishment that happens on the civilian side is a much different animal. There's such thing as Article Number 90 under non-judicial punishment, which can cover such a broad range of things. Essentially not saluting at the right time or something like that, all could be essentially disseminated at that point, which is a fairly minor infraction. And also, can you speak to the aspect of what it looks like for these members in regards to moving forward with their service record? I mean, essentially, their service record already exists. So if this is just going from military branch to military branch, their service record should already contain all of this information and not need Wyoming statutory enforcement.
Vice Chairman Laux.
Well, I don't know if I can answer the good man's questions or not, but all I know is that I think it's a good policy for our military to be able to know any past criminal activities with people that are under their purview at the time. Has a good chance of keeping things from happening that we've seen in Colorado in the last few months. Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The discussion so far has been about providing the background checks themselves, but I'm looking to page 2, bottom of page 2, when we start talking about fingerprinting. So this reads, the following person shall be required, requiring them to submit to fingerprinting in order to obtain state and national criminal history. And I'm wondering if the committee could speak more to the requirement for fingerprinting. I'm not seeing the nexus.
Vice Chairman Laux.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the language you just read is already in the statute. There's only the additions this is pertaining to the military department and them being fingerprinted. And so it just adds the language that you see, but that's already in there. So.
Chairman Greer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just help me with what a completed investigation is. Because if an investigation is completed and no charges are brought, that means there's nothing to worry about for that person. So why do we need it?
Vice Chairman Laux. Chairman,
I saw the chairman raise his hand, but that's a good point, Mr. Chairman. That's the language led by the Senate. I surely didn't have a problem with it, but I guess the military wants to know everything they can about the people under their charge.
Chairman Eklund.
So, we're kind of getting off track on what this does. This is information that the military needs, and it's concerning civilian crimes and penalties that they cannot receive. They're for whatever reason, law enforcement is not allowed to give them that information, and that's what this legislation is here to correct. It then allows the proper agencies to disseminate information concerning the criminal records of people that will then go into the military, and the military needs this to determine whether or not these service members are deployable or employable. And it's already on record, but the military can't get the information.
Representative Blake.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the main thing we're missing here is the military wants to know if they're in trouble, maybe have charges pending or anything. They're not going to make a judgment before they deploy them overseas for maybe a year. That's the kicker. Are they in trouble before they get deployed?
Chairman Greer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand the argument, but this is the wrong way to go about it. The military has a right to get the criminal background. They have the right to do the fingerprinting. When you join the military, you give up a certain amount of rights, and you understand that when you do this. But here's what we're talking about. We're talking about a civilian investigation, not a determination that you've actually done something wrong. And the language as it reads now says a completed investigation. Well, there are no charges brought, then that investigation must not have been enough evidence there for a prosecutor to bring those charges. But even if it just said an ongoing investigation, you're just accused in the civil system. In the civil system. And you're still, as far as I recall, you're innocent until proven guilty. So I just think this is an overreach. I'm one of those guys that served. I'm opposed to this.
Majority Whip Summers.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I guess on and concerned, I do think it's fixable. So I wonder if we can fix it in a second reading amendment. I think the problem is including any completed investigations. I think if you go on down, I think the dissemination of criminal history, I think at the point it becomes criminal history, you've had a conviction. I'm not a lawyer, but I think that part of it's probably okay. I think it's that one piece. So I wonder going forward, if we allow it to go forward, perhaps we can fix the one piece if the good lawyers in the room can kind of put their minds to it.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, I'm going to go back to the fingerprinting because I guess it was a little confusing. I wasn't just trying to talk about the existing statute. I'm talking about the changes to the existing statute. So my understanding is that an individual who enlists in the military is subject to an SSBI, which is a single-scope background investigation, and his fingerprint is already put on file. So what confuses me then, this is what I'm trying to understand, is the requirement in state statute to then again subject the military member, bottom of page 2, line 23, reads, or active duty or Wyoming National Guard military members, carrying over to page 3, line 1. I'm confused. If they already are subjected to the fingerprint, I just don't understand why that's taking place a second time, if the committee could help me understand that.
Chairman Eklund.
Okay. We're all kind of learning on this deal. So there's a conviction, they have that material. But if there's an ongoing investigation and there is no conviction, the military can't get the information that they need concerning this person. If they don't have that information, they can't deploy them. And that's what this legislation is here to correct, I believe.
Vice Chairman Laux.
Mr. Chairman, I want to go back to the previous speaker concerning the fingerprinting process. I mean, all I see is they're trying to add the language, the military part of one, they'll add language in there, or active duty, or Wyoming National Guard members. Because before it just says prospective employees of, as in a new hire, or volunteers of the Wyoming Military Department. So they want the language in there so they can get that information too. because active duty and national guard are not in there in the original language on it. So, and concerning the bill as a whole, I mean, I can understand the argument on the added clause on page two in there, and we surely can probably look at an amendment there. So, thank you very much,
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Folks, I just want to bring this, and I admit I was sort of multitasking, but if you pull up your statutes on your computer, if you've got it out, here's the thing that I think we're missing. If you pull up 719-106, it gives this long list, I don't know, 10, 15 places that can receive criminal record information. And so it lists, and I don't have my computer in front of me, but it lists various kind of other criminal investigation places. It lists the agencies that, you know, look at child abuse and that sort of stuff. I mean, there's a list of organizations that can receive criminal records. And so I think what we're kind of missing here, and I, as I say, I kind of have been multitasking, but if we look at page 2, line 5, okay, the military department is part of that list, but only for employees and volunteers. That's what the previous speaker was trying to point out, and I think that we're missing. So the military department can ask for this information for its employees. Is a military member an employee? Probably not really. And they're not a volunteer. That I'm just saying that may be the argument. So that I think what we're missing is that they're trying to put this in to clarify that they're considered an employee of the military department. And I agree with about two-thirds of the people in this room that I think we want to take out that completed investigations, and probably everybody here will have, you know, an amendment, second reading amendment to do that. But I think we just need to, if you pull up that statute list on your computer, if you want to see, I think that's what they're trying to do here, and that I think we're going a little bit astray in what we're thinking of.
Representative Lindholm.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just want to reiterate also the concern brought by the good representative from the capital city in regards to the fingerprinting aspect at the bottom of page 2. Essentially what we're looking at, even when I went in 2001 and I got fingerprints then, so why is Wyoming statute demanding that we fingerprint also? I don't believe that's a purview of the state, nor do I think that belongs in Wyoming statute. So with that considered, with the portion on completed investigations, just because they do an investigation on you and they don't prosecute, now suddenly that can affect your career. So that's a pretty big aspect. With the fingerprinting aspect, I'm going to vote no on this.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just now put my finger on what bothers me about this bill, that the information is only being requested to go from the civilian to the military agencies. Yet, don't we have a problem with the other way around? Didn't we have a church shooter in the Lone Star State that had the military provided the civilian authorities with some background information? That might have been prevented. So until this is fleshed out another 50%, I am a no vote.
Chairman Eklund.
So I think we're trying to correct something that rarely happens, but when it does happen, the person they're requesting the criminal information on is being damaged because their career cannot proceed forward. The military can't. Their hands are tied. There's an investigation. The investigators are sitting around for the example was used 15 months. It could be 2 years or however long it takes them to get that information out. And if they don't get it out, then you've got somebody's career that's sidelined for that period of time, and the military doesn't know whether they can deploy them or train them or do anything. And so they're just wanting the information for their own use, and it's not to be made public, and it probably will never see the light of day until the other prosecutors bring it out.
Vice Chairman Laus.
Well, I'm real happy with not saying anything more on it, to be honest with you. So, I think we can fine-tune this and get an amendment in if we pass it on to second reading. So, appreciate your eye vote. Let's call for the question, please.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Eklund's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Senate File 32 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Chairs in doubt. Those that are in favor, please stand. Those, you can be seated. Those opposed, please stand. The bill fails 26-25. Pursuant to House Rule 10-5B, Senate File 32, having failed, we need to take a roll call vote. We'll get to that point in a second. Chief Clerk will call the roll.
Senate File 32, Allen. Aye. Barlow. Excused. Biteman. No. Blackburn. Aye. Blake. Aye. Bovee. Excused. Brown.
Aye.
Aye. Burkhart.
No.
Bird.
No.
Clausen.
No.
Clem.
No.
Connolly.
No.
Court.
Aye.
Crank.
Aye.
Dayton.
Aye.
Edwards.
Aye.
Eklund.
Aye.
Ayer.
Aye.
Flitner.
Aye.
Freeman.
Aye.
Furphy.
Aye.
Giroux.
Aye.
Gray.
Aye.
Greer.
No.
Haley.
Aye.
Hallinan.
No.
Halverson.
No.
Henderson.
Aye.
Hunt.
No.
Jennings.
No.
Kinner.
Aye.
Kirkbride.
Aye.
Larson Lloyd.
No.
Larson Dan.
No.
Lindholm.
No.
Lone.
No.
Laux.
Aye.
McGuire.
No.
Madden.
Aye.
Miller.
No.
Nicholas.
No.
Northrop excused. Obermuller.
Aye.
Olson.
No.
Paxton.
Aye.
Pelkey.
No.
Piperinen.
No.
Ponnell.
No.
Salazar.
Aye.
Schwartz.
Aye.
Simpson.
No.
Summers.
No.
Steinmetz.
No.
Stith.
No.
Sweeney.
Aye.
Aye. Walters.
No.
Wilson.
Aye.
Winters.
No.
Zwanitzer.
Aye.
Mr. Speaker, excused. Closing vote. Are there any changes? Allen, aye to no. Further changes? Closing vote. The vote is closed. 27 aye, 29 no, 4 excused.
Pursuant to House Rule 10-5B, Senate File 32, having failed, a roll call vote is indefinitely postponed. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 33. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 33, introduced by Transportation, Highway, and Military Affairs. Military member spouse and children, resident tuition, an act relating to higher education and uniformed service members. Mr. Chairman, this bill was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Blackburn, Blake, Brown, Court, Crank, Edwards, Eklund, Laux, Piperinen. Signed, Representative Eklund, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Eklund. Your mic, please, Mr. Chairman. your mic.
Are you?
Chairman
Echler. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation that Bill number 33, Senate file 33, do pass. And I turn the explanation over to my colleague from the land of the river that is green.
Representative Blake.
Wow. I hope this goes better than the last military bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Proud to bring you Senate File 33. What this does, if you look on page 2 of your bill, we're just changing some language. This is already in law. This legislation updates current Wyoming statutes concerning active duty dependents receiving resident tuition at higher education institutes in state to include new federal definitions found in 38 U.S. Code 3679C2. Bill concerns program commonly called the post 9/11 GI Bill. Essentially, a housekeeping bill to remove language of active duty member, spouse, and dependents and replace with new federal language of eligible individuals and covered individuals. I'd ask for your favorable consideration. And if I could answer any questions, I might.
Representative Lindholm.
Yeah, sorry, Mr. Chairman, for talking so much. I figured I'd taken someone's spot. Can you specifically describe what covered individual means and the difference between covered individual and eligible individual, please?
Representative Blake.
I was just going to say no, I can't, but I think... what was that question again?
Representative Lindholm.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The difference between covered individual and eligible individual.
Representative Blake.
Well, because I think the thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry about that. I think previously it said spouse and dependents. That really didn't say that if they were eligible individuals or covered individuals. This way, then we know that they're covered under this GI Bill there and they're eligible. Because you might have a spouse that you're no longer with anymore. Under this bill, she may not be covered or be an eligible individual.
Chairman Eklund.
So we had a bit of an education on the GI Bill, and there's the old GI Bill that our dads might have went to college on. And the rules for that were different than the post 9/11 GI Bill. Post 9/11 included a lot of other people besides active combat veterans, and this cleanup then allows those people that are serving in the military that haven't served in a war, not veterans of a war, to be eligible for our tuition programs, and that's really all it does. If I understand it correctly, it's to correct the language in our present law, which included a GI Bill that was pre 9/11.
Majority Whip Summers.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I'm going to vote for this, but maybe the good chairman of transportation can get the, if this expands the list, in other words, if this expands a group of people, perhaps he can find that out and get us what that list is so we clearly understand what we're voting on. I'll go ahead and support it now, but I would like to understand what the expanded list looks like. If he could get that at another time, that would be great. Thanks.
Representative Blake.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under that statute I previously stated, 3679C2, for purposes of this subsection, a covered individual is an individual as follows. A veteran who is discharged or released from a period of not fewer than 90 days of service of the active military, naval, or air service less than 3 years before the date of enrollment in the course concerned. An individual who is entitled to assistance under Section 331
and 3319 of this title by virtue of such individual's relationship to a veteran described in subparagraph A. That is the definition, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion? Representative Lindholm.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I really appreciate defining covered covered individual. Can you tell me the difference between covered and individual, covered individual and eligible individual? And also under your definition of covered individual, it said someone that had to have been in active duty for or in the military for 90 days or longer. That didn't specifically say whether that was a dishonorable discharge or what. And I know that's probably not something we want to do.
Chairman Eklund.
Well, I think on honorable discharge, and that would probably be included in federal law. So I don't think we need to get in. We would be getting into the weeds probably with what they're saying. The expansion to Wyoming, there are no costs to Wyoming. This is paid for by the federal government. And I don't know if that was made clear. Eligible individual or covered individual, probably just a, it sounds like the same thing. Let me think about that a minute. You've got another question over here.
Majority Floor Leader Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The more I listen and the more I read, the more confused I get. Are these dependents or children or spouses living in Wyoming, or are they anywhere in the country that are married to a veteran? And if the veteran's VA benefits are going to pay the higher out-of-state tuition rate, why wouldn't we let them do that?
Any further discussion? Chairman Eklund.
Yeah, so we're supposed to be dealing with state law, not federal law, but the eligibility, the expansion of this, in so eligible individuals and covered individuals, you've got post 9/11, you've got children, and then you include stepchildren, and you include some spouses in various cases, but it's just an expanded version of the GI Bill, and that's a language they choose to use. I don't know if we dare amend that out of there.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Blake.
I just wanted to really let everybody know this is 100% federal funds, no state funds. Call for the question.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Eklund's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 33 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Senate File 33 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 37. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 37, introduced by Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs. Purple Heart Day and State, an act relating to legal time and holidays. Mr. Chairman, this bill was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Signed, Representative Eklund, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. Chairman Eklund, what's your pleasure?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that Senate File Number 37 do pass, and I turn the explanation over to my colleague across the room here.
Representative Crank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 37, Purple Heart, Heart Day Recognition. The Purple Heart is the oldest military decoration in present use and was initially created by General George Washington on August 7th, 1782. It is awarded to those members of the armed forces who are wounded or paid the ultimate sacrifice in combat against enemies of this country. This legislation designates August 7th, the date the award was created, as Purple Heart Day in Wyoming. If this day is created, the Wyoming and Veterans Commission will work with military veterans organizations to observe the day with appropriate activities and celebrations in honor of Purple Heart recipients. The bill also designates the state of Wyoming as a Purple Heart state in recognition of the sacrifice of the military members who received the award, in which an estimated 4,400 Wyoming citizens. To date, there are 22 states that have proclamations of the Purple Heart states. This bill is also, with this bill, we ask for a little support to those who have given so much to this country, and I ask for your favorable consideration on the bill.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Eklund's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate file number 37 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate file 37 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate file 44.
Senate file 44, introduced by Agriculture, State and Public Lands, and Water Resources. Fire Protection Revolving Account, an act relating to the Fire Protection Revolving Account. Mr. Chairman, this bill was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Representatives Burkhart, Larson, Nicholas, Schwartz, Summers, Walters, and Wilson. Signed, Representative Nicholas, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Chairman Nicholas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, it do so with a recommendation that Senate File 44 do pass, and along with the amendment, and I would turn the explanation of the bill and the amendment over to the good chairman of over there.
Chairman Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I present to you Senate File 44, and this is the Fire Protection Revolving Account, a name that I absolutely could not get right in committee the other night. But anyway, so the gist of this bill is, currently this account, the Fire Protection Revolving Account, is used for reimbursing the state for the local fire districts, county districts, for services that are done on federal land or out of state. And so the way that it currently works is a local county, a local district sends its resource out to a federal case or out of state, and then when that person gets back, when that unit gets back, or whatever they may be, they put in their bill, and then the state forestry audits that, and then they send it to the federal agency or the state responsible for the service that indebted to, and then that comes back. The problem is currently that this is a process that takes somewhere between 3 and 7 months, depending on how busy the fire season is, and so the revolving account often finds itself seriously depleted because of this time lag. And so what this bill simply aims to do is to say that to speed up that process so that when the reimbursement comes back, that it goes straight into this account rather than going into the general fund where it currently goes. And so good folks at JAC brought an amendment to this, which injects $700,000 to the account to sort of get that off the ground and moving, so that when if the bill passes, once the restructuring occurs, the $700,000 cushion is in there to help it get it off the ground and keep moving, and so hopefully there won't be a depletion again. So that's the gist of it. Thank you,
Chairman Kirkbride.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I bring a message from one of my constituents who's a deputy county fire warden and also works on a regional team. He says this is an important bill. It would enable the firefighters to get paid in a timely fashion. He said the exact same thing the good chairman said, that now it takes up to 2 to 6 months, and if that time lapse was eliminated, it might encourage other
firefighters to go out on fires and volunteer. So he said it's a good bill. That's his words. Go for it.
Is there any other discussion? Any question being called? Let me find my question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Nicholas's motion that when the committee of the whole, oh, pardon me, we've got an amendment on this piece of legislation. Ooh. Chairman Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My apologies. And I do believe that the amendment it's also was moved by the good chairman of JAC. So I would call for the question on the amendment.
Question being called on the standing committee amendment number one. Hang on. I think Chairman Zawanitzer has a question.
I do, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like some explanation on what it is and how it works, you know, debate the process. Thanks.
Chairman Zawanitzer would like to know what your amendment does, Chairman Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's technically not my amendment, but I would be happy to try and explain it. Again, the JAC was able to... I'll just shut up.
Chairman Nicholas.
Thank you. Slight miscommunication between us. So when this came to the committee, there was part of the purpose was in order to expend more funds for those firefighters that go out of state and then finance their own travel, stay, and then come back in. And then they apply for reimbursement that then goes, and that reimbursement that the volunteer firemen is submitted to the state, it's audited, comes back, and then is shipped out to the national folks who reimburse for these funds. And sometimes that can be 2 or 3 or 4 months where they're, where they don't have, with basically those volunteer firemen are, have to expend all these out-of-pocket dollars and do not get reimbursed. So the original purpose of this bill was to expend additional dollars to help cover those costs prior to reimbursement. So the state would pay them back and then be reimbursed for those dollars when it came back from that federal entity that reimburses those costs. The problem was that there were no dollars available to actually reimburse from. So we reached in and found some other dollars, put those other dollars into this bill. So the amendment locates those dollars and appropriates it to this account so dollars will be able to be available to effectuate the purpose of the bill.
Any further questions on the amendment? Question being called on the amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Representative Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just would like to receive a little more reassurance from the folks on appropriations. Yeah, I voted for this when this came to ag, but I was a little bit, just had some questions about commingling these funds for the trucks and the fire protection revolving account with now this reimbursement process. So, you know, I just had a question. I mean, I was thinking maybe we could just create another account to do this. Are you concerned about that at all?
Yes, we were concerned about it. It was our exact question. Oh, excuse me, Mr. Chair. We were concerned about it, and we were informed that they will keep the funds separate, account for them appropriately, as because there's an audit for each where funds came from that comes in from the dollars that we appropriated, and that they will not be commingled.
Chairman Hunt? No, any further discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of... Chairman Nicholas's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 44 do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 44 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 53. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 53, introduced by Agriculture, State and Public Lands and Water Resources. Small Water Projects, an act relating to water development. Mr. Chairman, this bill was... Mr. Chairman, this bill was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State and Public Lands and Water Resources, and returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Blake, Clausen, Gray, Haley, Henderson, Hunt, Larson, and Simpson. Excused, Representatives Thimetz. Signed, Representative Hunt, Chairman.
Further reading of the bill, what is your pleasure? Chairman Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've moved that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 53 do pass, and I would further turn the explanation of the bill over to the good newest member of the Ag Committee, whose district I can't remember, but he's standing right over there.
Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you understand the process, when a community or a district or a water or irrigation district has a need in their system, they come to the Wyoming Water Development Commission and request a study be performed. Those studies are typically then placed into the Level 1 or Level 2 study process. However, there are small projects that come to the Water Development Commission that it appears to be overkill to designate them for significant studies. These are usually brought by conservation districts, and a typical example of this is a small dam for stock watering for an irrigation district. This is called the Small Water Program. Currently, projects are capped at a total project cost of $135,000, with water development able to share cost share 50-50, 50% grant, 50% either loan or the entity comes up with that portion, up to a limit of $35,000. That is the maximum they participate. This bill, I direct your attention to page 2, lines 2 through 5 and 16 through 19 do the same thing. This lifts the cap of $135,000, so a project can come in, let's say, for example, at $185,000 total cost. That includes the construction engineering, construction, land right-of-ways. All those items are included, and they will still participate with that if it's eligible, recognizing that the Water Development Commission only goes to $35,000. That's their cap, and we're keeping that portion of the cap in, so a larger project can come in, but the 35 participation is still capped. I recommend that this bill receive passage.
Chairman Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question to the bringer of the bill is, what if the total project costs $40,000? In other words, is there skin in the game by the owner of the land? And if that's the case, I'd like to know that. And then the other thing is that really, I think these projects go on private land, so it benefits a private person. And maybe you could talk about, well, I don't know if you want to, you know, whether it's constitutional to be passing money out like that when the Constitution says you can't.
Majority Whip Summers.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And so I guess my concern with the bill is the very definition. It says small projects. So this was designed to go out and do small water projects around the state of Wyoming. And so what they did is they capped that figure at $135,000. So that was the definition of a small project. And so now it seems to me that we're expanding this to I don't know where. At some point you trigger what is not a small project, which is another water development type project. But what I worry about is that there was a reason that this was done, which was to try to get small water projects done around the state of Wyoming with grants of up to $35,000, which I think was a really, really good endeavor. But now I'm worried that this is going to be sucked into much larger projects, and we are going to lose those small projects around the state. So my one question is, I'm not sure I'm going to vote for the bill anyway, but my one question is why didn't we put another cap in this? If you didn't like $135,000, then should it have been $250,000, $500,000, $300,000? And so I worry that we lose that small project piece and we're going to something else. So on and concerned once again.
Representative Simpson.
The answer to the first question is, they participate, Water Development Commission, up to $70,000 50-50. So if a $40,000 project comes in, it's 20 and 20, 50-50, so we don't lose anything in that regard. I don't think we're discussing the merits of the small water program. It's an existing system that's been going on. The Select Water Committee is the author of this bill, and their feeling was that if a larger project comes in, that just means we participate less. It's okay to let them participate on a greater emphasis, because our participation percentage-wise just goes down and down. It shouldn't edge others out, because they're still based on their own merit. And for your information, there have been 32 of these projects have been funded year-to-date. They are done under a legal entity, for example, a conservation district.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is a good bill, and hope you vote for it. I just want to clarify some stuff. There is a limit of $35,000, no matter what the project is, or 50-50, depending on, you know, if it's less than $70,000. Also, you want to make sure that you realize it's for public entities, conservation districts, watershed improvement districts, water conservation districts, municipalities, Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone tribes, and other approved assessment districts. Eligible projects could include small reservoirs, wells, solar platforms, pipelines and conveyance facilities, springs, wetland development, environmental, irrigation, windmills, rural community fire suppression, and recreational. And just to give you a brief, what some projects that have been completed since 2015, we've had 61 small reservoirs, 36 wells, 39 solar platforms, 40 pipelines, 24 springs, 12 wetlands, 4 environmental projects, and 20 irrigation systems. So it's a good project. I think raising the limit isn't a big deal, but vote for it.
Majority Whip Summers.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I do realize there's a limit of $35,000. My question was, this is a great program. But if we're going to increase that cap from $135,000, and maybe the good bringer of the good speaker about the bill said, but if we're going to increase this and expand this use to much larger size projects, one is that how many of those are there out there? So is that going to significantly diminish the number of this was originally put aside as small projects? So is it going to restrict that amount down because we're going to have a lot more projects? And maybe we won't. I don't know the answer to that. But I think maybe it was mentioned and I missed it in a side conversation. But if it does, I would like to know that. And I'm a no vote on this anyway, but maybe you can change my mind.
Representative Simpson.
I don't know all the situations that could come forward in the future. However, I'd remind you that if they go through the other process, they get, for a $1,000 application fee, they get a significant study, $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 engineering evaluation. Then they go into level 3, which is a 67% grant to do a larger project. So I don't think we're going to see a run on the bank on large projects for this small amount, because they're going to want to go for the bigger construction grants.
Chairman Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I think I know where that question was going. We have some projects that fall into a gap that are ineligible. So you've got your small ones that are under a certain cost, and then you've got these big ones that are over this $135,000. This allows some projects that couldn't get the minimum amount of funding, which would be a small water project, done because they were caught in that gap. And I hope that answers the question.
Chairman Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the good Chairman of Transportation for saying part of what I was going to say. I was distracted for a moment. But to answer to some of the concerns that have been raised here, that this is going to either drain the account or that that smaller projects are going to get shoved out of the way. I think that there were some members of our committee who raised those exact same concerns, but here's the deal. Is that at the end of the day, regardless of whether there's a cap or not, this is going to go through the exact same process that it goes through before as far as vetting is concerned. And so the entity, the local, the irrigation district, whatever it is, the NRCS, puts in for the application, the office reviews it, it goes to the commission, and then it goes to Select Water, and ultimately it comes to us as the body. And so I think that there's still plenty of I really use the term these days, sideboards, and checkpoints in place to ensure that this is not abused. And it is also up to the discretion of the office and of the commission to decide whether or not that a particular project is appropriate for this fund or not, because funds out there. There are other project sizes out there, and programs is the word I'm looking for. There are other programs out there, and so it can still be up to the commission and to the office and, once again, to the committee to determine whether or not a project should be appropriate for small water or for one of the other existing applications. So I'm in favor of the bill.
Any further discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Hunt's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 53 do pass, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 53 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next Senate file for our consideration is Senate File 54. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 54. Introduced by Agriculture, State and Public Lands, and Water Resources. Water Development Project Requirements, an act relating to water development. Mr. Chairman, this bill was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State and Public Lands, and Water Resources, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Blake, Clausen, Gray, Haley, Henderson, Hunt, Larson, and Simpson. Excused, Representative Steinmetz. Signed, Representative Hunt, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure? Chairman Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move Senate File 54 and ask for its favorable consideration and would turn the explanation of the bill over to the good representative from District 39.
Representative Blake.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Glad to bring you Senate File 54 from the Select Water Committee. What this does is we want to make sure we loan this money out, that the entities have enough money to have an operations and maintenance, enough money to assess that. So bottom of page one, prior to authorizing a water development project, the commission shall require each project sponsor to demonstrate the entity has the authority to adequately assess fees or collect funds to operate or to cover operation and maintenance expenses related to the water development project. They don't have that authority, may be required by the commission to establish a maintenance account as provided, and the commission shall develop criteria related to the establishment of the O&M account, and that will include, shall only be required for project sponsors that have taken out a loan for any portion of the project and shall not be required after the loan has been repaid. So we've had entities come there who really didn't have the means or wherewithal to assess fees and collect money. We just want to make sure they're able to pay for this and so they can operate and maintain it during the life of the loan. So I'd ask for your favorable consideration. Call for the question if there are no questions.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, question being called, all those in favor of Representative Hunt's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 54 do pass, please say aye. Those opposed, no. Senate File 54 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 24. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 24, introduced by Judiciary, Court Information Technology Equipment, an act relating to courts and counties. Mr. Chairman, this bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Biteman, Jennings, Kirkbride, Olson, Pelkey, Ponell, Salazar, Stith, and Winters. Signed, Representative Kirkbride. This bill was then re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Burkhart, Larson, Nicholas, Schwartz, Summers, Walters, and Wilson. Signed, Representative Nicholas, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Kirkbride.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I bring you Senate File 2424, Courtroom Information Technology Equipment. And the purpose of the bill is really summarized there in the title. It's a bill about delineating the responsibility for court information technology equipment between the judicial branch and the counties. And I should say, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 24 do pass. So the court system is responsible for 69 different courtrooms. It's broader than you might think. The list of all the facilities is on page 3, beginning on line 16. But we're talking about circuit and district courtrooms, circuit and district court jury rooms, the circuit and district court judges' chambers, and the offices of circuit court clerks. It behooves the system greatly to have up-to-date technology. There's savings to be had in terms of time and travel. You can have a judge in one town filling in for a judge in another town. You can have just save a trip halfway across the state in some instances, so that's very beneficial. There's savings in terms of safety. Sometimes you can leave the suspect over in the jail and have him on video and not risk the safety of the proceedings by bringing him into the courtroom itself. And they're just added benefits to having good communication for everybody who's in the courtroom experiencing the trials or the procedures. The equipment they're talking about procuring, it's listed there in the back on the fiscal note, but largely it would be good sound equipment for the courtroom itself, good video equipment, and some video conferencing equipment to facilitate their work. The implementation of the bill is found first on page 2, line 17, where it says it must be done in consultation with the county commissioners in each county. And then there's mention on page 4, line 4, of the county responsibilities in all this, and their responsibility, the little term for it, is to the wall. They don't have to provide all that fancy equipment inside the room, but they have to wire it up in anticipation of that fancy equipment. And then it's the state court's responsibility to maintain that equipment once it's in place, and that's on page 3, line 4. The funding for all this is accomplished by stacking away in an account the judicial system automation fee to the point where you have a judicial systems automation account, and it's heading for $6 million. And so the courts are asking to begin to appropriate this money out of the courtroom account, $1.9 million at a time for the next 3 years. And probably the most important thing about the bill is it was a good collaboration between the state court system and the 23. And I don't know that they worked out every little detail for the next 10 years, but they got together on it and they seem very comfortable with it as they proceed. So that's my explanation of the bill, and I'll stand for any questions.
Any discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Kirkbride's motion that when a committee of the whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 24 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 24 has passed the committee of the whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I move the committee of the whole rise and report.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. All right. The motion passes.
The reading clerk will read the committee of the whole report.
Mr. Speaker Pro Tem, our committees of the whole have had under consideration bills on general file begged to leave report as follows. Senate File 2, recommended do pass. Senate File 3, withdrawn. Senate File 3, correction. Recommended do pass. Okay. Senate File 5, recommended do pass. Senate File 6, recommended do pass. Senate File 7, recommended do pass. Senate File 8, recommended do pass. Senate File 9, recommended do pass. Representative Miller moved that the House rise and sit again. Senate File 16, recommended do pass. Senate File 18, recommended do pass. Senate File 20, recommended do pass. Senate File 21, recommended do pass. Senate File 25, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 26, recommended do pass. Senate File 27, recommended do pass. Senate File 50, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 31, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 32, following a failed roll call vote, the bill is deemed indefinitely postponed. Senate File 33, recommended do pass. Senate File 37, recommended do pass. Senate File 44, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 53, recommended do pass. Senate File 54, recommended do pass. Senate File 24, recommended do pass. Signed, Representative Clem, Chairman.
Mr. Speaker Pro Tem, I move the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye. All opposed, no. Congratulations, Representative Clem. Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 22, engrossed, Orders of Protection Revisions, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Representatives Biteman, Jennings, Kirkbride, Olson, Pelkey, Ponell, Salazar, Stith, and Winters. Signed, Representative Kirkbride, Chairman. Mr. Speaker Pro Tem, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 66, engrossed, Volunteer Health Care, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Biteman, Olson, Pelkey, Ponell, Salazar, and Winters. No, Representative Jennings. Excused, Representatives Kirkbride and Stiff. Signed, Representative Winters, Vice Chairman. Mr. Speaker Pro Tem, your committee number two, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 40, engrossed, Commercial Air Service Improvement, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Representatives Burkhart, Larson, Nicholas, Schwartz, Summers, Walters, and Wilson. Signed, Representative Nicholas, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, pro tem, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 36, engrossed, Interfund Loan Accounts and Interest Rates, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Burkhart, Larson, Nicholas, Schwartz, Summers, Walters, and Wilson. Signed, Representative Nicholas, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, pro tem, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 89, Local Government Distributions, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Burkhart, Larson, Nicholas, Schwartz, Summers, Walters, and Wilson. Signed, Representative Nicholas, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, pro tem, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred Senate File 10, engrossed. Utilities, Rate Making, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Representatives Blackburn, Byrd, Edwards, Ayer, Furphy, Lindholm, Lone, Sweeney, and Zwanitzer. Signed, Representative Zwanitzer, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, pro tem, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred Senate File 11, Public Utility Regulation, Joint Powers Entities, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Blackburn, Byrd, Edwards, Ayer, Furphy, Lindholm, Lone, Sweeney, and Zwanitzer. Signed, Representative Zwanitzer, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, pro tem, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred Senate File 113, engrossed, Community Development Districts, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Blackburn, Byrd, Edwards, Ayer, Furphy, Lindholm, Lone, Sweeney, and Zwanitzer. Signed, Representative Lindholm, Vice Chairman. Mr. Speaker, pro tem, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred Senate File 116, engrossed, Retirement Income Security Task Force 2, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Representatives Ayer, Furphy, Lindholm, Sweeney, and Zwanitzer. Noes, Representatives Blackburn, Byrd, Edwards, and Lone. Signed, Representative Zwanitzer, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, pro tem, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred Senate File 42, engrossed, Professional Licensing Applicant Criminal Records, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass, amended. Ayes, Representatives Barlow, Clem, Dayton, Garou, Hallinan, Halverson, Sweeney. Noes, Representatives Lone and McGuire. Signed, Representative Halverson, Vice Chairman.
Chairman Kirkbride.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker pro tem. I'd like to ask for 2 re-referrals, one on Senate File 22, the other on Senate File 66, engrossed, both to committee number 2.
Senate File 22 and Senate File 67, engrossed. 66, engrossed, are re-referred to committee number 2, Appropriations.
Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Zwanitzer.
Thanks. I need to re-refer Senate File 116 to your committee number 2, Appropriations.
Senate File 116 is re-referred to committee number 2, Appropriations. Any others? Okay. Committee announcements. And I will take the first one. Rules Committee number 12 will meet tomorrow on noon recess in Jonah L-54 to hear Senate File 68, Amendments to Agency Plans and New Program Review 2, and Senate File 70, Engrossed, Revisers Bill. Chairman Greer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker pro tem. Your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, Economic Development, will meet tomorrow morning, Friday, March 2nd, 8 a.m. in Jonah Room H-37, where we will take up Senate File 115, excuse me, Senate File 15, Senate File 17, and Senate File 111.
Yeah, go ahead. Okay. Vice Chair Paxton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Pro Tem, your committee number 4, Education, will be meeting tomorrow upon noon recess in room H38 to consider the following bills: Senate File 102, National Teacher Teaching Certification; Senate File 117, Engrossed School Finance Amendment 3.
Chairman Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker Pro Tem. Your committee number 6, Travel, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock in H38 to consider three bills: Bingo and Pull Tabs, which is Senate File 4. Senate File 2 is the 150th Fort Laramie Treaty Proclamation. And Senate File 58, which is Game of Fish Licenses. And also keep in mind that we will do interim topics Monday morning at a same room.
Chairman Kirkbride.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Pro Tem. Committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet Friday upon noon recess. That's an unusual time, and we're also meeting in an unusual room. We'll be meeting in L56. So tomorrow noon at L56 to consider three bills: Senate File 30, a notice of hearing to reopen an estate amendments; Senate File 57, Board of Law Examiners appointment, Supreme Court rules; and Senate File 80, Engrossed Vulnerable Adults.
Chairman Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker Pro Tem. Your committee number 5, Agriculture, will meet tomorrow at noon recess to discuss Senate File 45, State Fair Board number 2, and Senate File 99, State Fairgrounds Horse Racing Events, in H36.
Vice Chair Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker Pro Tem. Committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet tomorrow, Friday, upon noon recess in our room H37 to deliberate on three bills: Senate File number 75, Biological Products; Senate File 83, Controlled Substance Prescription Tracking; and Senate File 105, Engrossed Drug Donation Program Act Expansion.
Representative Walters.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 2, Appropriations, will meet on adjournment today to continue the work that we were conducting at noon and did not complete. Committee number 2 will also meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in room L55 to hear four bills: Senate File 121, State Funded Capital Construction 2, Senate File 95, Medicare Discrimination, Senate File 100, Engrossed Economic Diversification Broadband Services, and Senate File 108, Engrossed Economic Diversification and Development. Again, that's at 8 a.m. tomorrow.
Chairman Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker Pro Tem. Your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, will meet upon adjournment. We'll discuss Senate File 84, Senate File 60, Senate File 34, and Senate File 35.
Any other committees? Okay. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Speaker Pro Tem, General File tomorrow will consist of House Bill 41, 81, 82, 90, 89, and other bills on the list that will be out later tonight. With that, Mr. Speaker Pro Tem, I move the House adjourn until 10 a.m., Friday, March 2nd, 2018.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Okay. We are adjourned.